everybody. We are here today with a first-time guest of the show, somebody who I just recently had the pleasure of meeting at All-Star Weekend / Week in Seattle. You may know him from several different places. You may know him if you're a baseball fan like me, from being a longtime Major League ball player. You may know him from his more recent work on Foul Territory. And you also may know him from his brand new book called The Tao of the Backup Catcher, Playing Baseball for the Love of the Game, written by Eric Kratz and Tim Brown. And I'm very proud to welcome Eric Kratz. Eric, how are you?
I am great. Thanks for having me on. All those things. People might know too much about me now. We might need to cut this down a little bit. I don't want everybody to know everything.
Well, I actually want to start like right there with the book, which is available now. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it, really, I would imagine, Eric, right, from anywhere where you generally get books. Is that a fair statement?
Anywhere you get a book. Absolutely. Beautiful. Yep. Amazon's an easy place, but it's in a lot of bookstores. If you want the hard copy immediately, it's everywhere. If you can't find it, I don't think you're looking.
So let's start with that. You know, there are many, many great baseball books, some by famous ball players or famous managers, some great baseball books by players that were not necessarily famous but became famous. I think, you know, Jim Bouton in Ball 4 is probably one of the great examples of that. What made you decide to write or co-write a book, or was it pitched to you? Is this an idea you've already had, or like, I'm curious sort of how it came to be for a 10-year major league catcher to turn that story into a book?
Well, it's kind of everything that you just said there. It was something that throughout my career, as you'll read in the book, it's a unique career path, but throughout my career, people, you know, I'd meet people or I'd go and speak places and they'd be like, you know, tell us about your career and this. And people would like, their mouths would just be like more and more open. Like, huh? What? What? You moved how many times? And so when I'd be done, people would come up to me afterwards and be like, you got to write a book. And as my English teacher can attest to all the C's that I got in writing, I really wasn't going to be the person to write the book, per se. I was going to be the person to tell about the book, find a writer. So I always wanted to write a book just because my career path is so unique in the sense of everybody hears about the superstars. And most of the books are written about the superstars, you know, besides a few here and there or like, you know, tragedy stories, that kind of thing, but it is, or somebody invents something in baseball, but my story, like everybody's story, is unique, but it was something that people were encouraging me, oh, you really need to just tell it so that your kids and your grandkids one day can know and understand partially what you went through, and what you had an opportunity to enjoy and experience. And so in 2018, I met Tim Brown doing his podcast, and I had never really met a writer who was so thoroughly aware, so thoroughly and researched about the person he was talking to. You know, some writers, they'll say, you know, I was drafted in the 29th round. Some will be like, oh, you know, I'm here with Eric Kratz from Telford, Pennsylvania, 28th round draft pick by Toronto Blue Jays. You know, it's a very minor detail. It's not a big deal, like, if they get that wrong. But Tim doesn't, you know, he is so, it may be to his own, from his own words, from his own admission, maybe a little over the top. But he is so well researched that when he came to me, this was in August of 2018, he came to me in September and was like, you ever think about writing a book about your career? And I was like, honestly, yes, but I can't write. And he's like, well, I'm pretty decent at it. And I would like to write. I've always wanted to write a book about backup catchers, because in his time writing, beat a beat on a beat, he always was connected to backup catchers. But you never really wrote stories about them. unless they did something bad or, you know, they had a good game, and then all of a sudden they have a good game and they become starting catchers. And then he's like, then I didn't have the same relationship with them. It was something that he loved, the relationship with those guys, and he didn't ever, he always felt like it's a relationship through his time in writing that never really, fans never really got to know backup catchers for the right reason. Like, they weren't the star. They weren't the guy that you were going to first, second, or third when it was time to talk to somebody.
There is no more position, I think, in sports that is probably more demanding of a person physically and mentally than that of a major league catcher. Now, I never played the game. I don't know. But, you know, from what I've observed and people I've talked to, for example, I've gotten to know Kevin Kennedy quite a bit over the years, who was a longtime minor league catcher and eventually made the major leagues and then was a major league manager. But he in particular really illuminated how, I mean, you can tell that it's physically demanding because you just watch, you know, it hurts me. I'm at an age where it literally hurts me to see a man kneel down 417 times in a game and then catch a ball that's coming anywhere between 85 and 104 miles an hour while somebody is standing between you swinging a large stick that could cause the trajectory of that ball to go in many different directions. But you also need to be the conductor on the field. Is that why you had a 10-year major league career? You didn't start playing in the majors until you were 30, and you played till you were 40. Is it the uniqueness of the position and the requirements that it take? Is that the reason why you might not have ever been the 160, 140, 120 game a year guy? Playing in the major leagues for 10 years at any position is a remarkable accomplishment. Is it because that catcher position is so demanding and you were able to sort of fill that role that is so crucial? Is that why you were able to spend 10 years in the league, especially one after you turn 30? Not a lot of guys turn 30 in their major league debut season and then wind up playing for another 10 plus years.
That is, You hit the nail on the head right there. It really is. It's part of, you know, why hopefully this book really takes off and is something that people gravitate to, because it doesn't happen. Like, you don't get, even going back before my major league career started, getting drafted. You know, I got drafted out of a Division III school. Well, nobody plays a ton of baseball in high school and is like, man, I can't wait till I play Division III. No, they're like, all right, I'll play Division III. It's fine. And for me, that was the only option I had. And before that, I barely made my varsity team as a junior in high school. So hopefully there's encouragement in that part of my career. And then there's encouragement in my minor league part of my career where things weren't necessarily going my way, but I was able to stick it out. People really vouched for me. People encouraged me. And then finally making it to the big leagues, ultimately, because I still talk to a lot of my minor league buddies who never made it. You know, you spend a lot of time in the minor leagues, you see guys year in and year out that never have an opportunity to make it. I see a guy like Drew Maggi this year with the Pirates. He made it. Most likely, he's not going to get parts of 11 more seasons in the big leagues like I was able to. But it's cool that he made it to the big leagues. Like, that's an awesome, awesome accomplishment. But I feel like I had a great major league career for the player that I was. And I talked to my buddies who never made it, and most of my buddies were better at baseball than me early in the minor leagues. The difference was they didn't catch. And catching, like you said, is such a unique position. You have to have two catchers on the team. You have to. The one may not be good. He may be good. But you have to have two catchers. You have to figure out a way to catch 162 games with two guys.
Well, not only that, most likely, you got to have a third guy ready to call up any second, right? Like,
exactly. Exactly. And I tell people, you can have a long career in the big leagues if you're okay not being the first guy selected, because you need a backup, you need a starter, and those are their first guys they're selecting. You got to be willing to be in AAA. You have to be willing to put extra work in so that you are A, playing well, which everybody works in the offseason, so they play well. Like, the work you put in, you get out of it, is what you get out of it. And to be able to play well, but you got to stay healthy. And if you don't stay healthy, when they go to pick their second guy, which is the third catcher out of the big leagues, I mean, out of AAA, to put them in the big leagues, if you're not healthy, they're not going to be like, well, we'll just wait a little bit. We'll wait till Eric gets healthy. No, they're like, all right, who's the next guy? Brett? There you go. And they won't even think twice. They won't be like, oh, man, hey, as soon as you're healthy, we want you to be in the big leagues. Now, they might think you're better than the other guy that they call up, but you know what? He's in the big leagues. He's serving that role. He is now on that team. They don't think about you when you're healthy, when you're not healthy, when you're on the IL. And that was something for me that I was very fortunate to be able to do, is stay healthy throughout my entire career, so that when they did get sick of their number one, you know, their first two options, or one of those guys gets hurt, or on some teams, six of those guys get hurt, you get called up and you get time, and you get, you know, I got 6+ years of service in the big leagues, and you accumulate service in the big leagues by a daily ticker. If you're in the big leagues Thursday, you get 1 day of service time. If you're there Friday, you get 2 days of service time. You know, it just, that's how it accumulates. And I was able to get 6 years of service time over 11 seasons, parts of 11 seasons. And all the things you said about, like, the physical and the mental side of it, this might sound a little self-sabotage, but that's what I loved about it. I loved it because people saw it as something that was like, whoa, how do you guys do that? And my body feels great. I didn't play as much as like an AJ Pierzynski, but even AJ, he said his body feels great and he played all the time. So I think some guys are built for that, but I love when people are like, oh man, I would squat for one inning and I wouldn't be able to walk for a week. And I'm like, okay, good. Good.
That's why I played 10 years in the major, pal. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's funny.
You're not going to take my job.
You know, I had the opportunity to meet you, and we had a brief chat at All-Star, and same thing with AJ. You and AJ, two catchers. You guys both look like you could go out there and play today. And in fact, in 2020, I know you know this, in 2020, you hit .321. You had a .321, .367, .393 slash as a 40-year-old catcher in the major leagues for the New York Yankees. Could you go back out there and play today? Could you do it? You sure look like you could.
I definitely could. Would you need me to do it tomorrow? No. I know that I could, because I know my throwing plan right now. I can throw BP for an hour to an hour and a half to the boys. But if you need me to get out there and play at a peak level, you pump the brakes on saying peak level when you're talking about myself. But it would take me 8 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay.
Because my throwing plan, long tossing, to be able to get back out there, but I'd be able to do it. And that 6 to 8 weeks, while I love working out, I love the grind of – loved the grind of the season, the switch that takes for me to be out there every day. And in the moment, you don't really notice it. You know you're locked in, but you're like, well, I'm supposed to be locked in.
Right.
To the point where it's like, hey, I got to go to bed. Oh, well, we're all hanging out. Okay, I understand. Have fun. Like, I have to go to bed. Like, I can't not get sleep just because I want to hang out.
Right.
I can't make it to my daughter's softball games, my son's baseball games, soccer games. Like, I can't eat what I want. I can't just take vacations whenever I want, because in the off season, there's a plan. And it sounds obsessive. It sounds like too excessive in the sense of, well, just relax. I can relax. But we interviewed Carlos Correa early in the season here on our on our show, Foul Territory, and he was like, if you want to relax, if you want to go on vacation, if you want to have a drink, if you want to have, you know, eat dessert, he's like, you can do that from when you're 38 years old until you die. Or in my case, 40 years old until you die. And I really gravitate towards him saying that, because that's what you have to do. You have to make decisions to want to be out there and give it everything you have, not just for yourself, but for your teammates. And so I would need to give myself 6 to 8 weeks, and I'd be ready. Absolutely. Because my knees feel great. My hips feel great. I am very, very fortunate in that sense. I wouldn't be limping off. The issue would be I'd miss so much that's going on at my house.
Yeah. I can respect that for sure. So now I want to take a little bit of a step back. You know, I mentioned this earlier. You debuted at age 30 in the year 2010 with the Pirates, your major league debut. But I have a feeling you weren't 28 or 29 years old when you got drafted out of college. So it sounds like you put in some time in the minor leagues. I don't want to ask the question that I'm sure you've been asked 1,000 times already, which I'll say it is, was there any doubt at any time that you'd get to the major leagues? Because I think, and I could be wrong, but, you know, human beings, I think having doubts is just innate in all of us. And even those who say they don't have doubts aren't telling the truth. So I'll ask you a different question. Did you know that you were going to get to the major leagues, right? Like, you did you know from the time when you got drafted to when you made your debut, did you know you were going to get there? It was just a matter of time, or were you just playing baseball, and if the major leagues happened, the major leagues happened? Or was it neither of those? Was it something different?
I was ignorant till the point that I was content with the plan that I felt God had me in my life. And that might sound confusing, but when I got drafted, my wife and I was already married when I got drafted. I was 21 when I graduated college, and we were like, all right, yeah, like, we'll give this 5 years, see what happens. Well, 8 years later, I finally made the big leagues. So I was ignorant. Like, I definitely thought I was good enough, but that was ignorant. I came from a Division III school, and I didn't know a quarter of what I needed to know. But I felt like I had the ability. I felt like I had the strength. I felt like I had the arm strength, and I felt like I had the work ethic. But I had no money behind me. I had, you know, plenty of people that were drafted ahead of me. And then the next season, plenty of people that were drafted ahead of me that got more money than me and, you know, had all this pedigree. But I was ignorant. Like, I was ignorant in the sense that I just kept chasing a dream. And then when it got to the point where I was like, oh man, these guys, they really don't care about me. I don't really have much of a shot with this organization. And they're showing me that by how much they move me around, how much they don't choose me. And at that point I was like, okay, the carrot kind of changed for me. Like, oh, I'm almost a minor league free agent. I can't give up now because I feel like I've taken it this far, and I got to at least see if another organization would give me a shot. And because people around me are telling me, well, you're a good player. I think you can play in the big leagues. I had coaches, I had managers with the Blue Jays that were telling me that I was good. The organization didn't think I was good. So it was something that I was hearing one thing, thinking the same thing, and being shown something completely different. And so it was like in my career going, well, you can make it, but nobody else thinks you can make it. And in no way was I like, oh, I have a chip on my shoulder, I need to show people, because I did that for like a quarter of a year, 1 year, and it just felt miserable. It just didn't feel like me. For me, I got strength from like encouraging my teammates, from helping them while also trying to make myself the best player that I could be. And there was different times when I felt like I shouldn't quit. And my wife was like, oh man, I don't know if we can do this. And there was times when I said, I don't know if I can do this. And she said, come on, you got this. And there was times when my dad said, are you really still doing this? And there was also, there was also times that my dad said, no, you got to keep doing this. And it's different times in the book. You know, we highlight different times in the book when it was time to quit for me, and he encouraged me. And then there was times when, you know, my sister encouraged me to stay in it, and then also encouraged me, like, you do realize, like, you have another son on the way. Like, you have a boy, and you have to, like, provide for your family, because they know how much I was making, all that stuff. But anyway.
And the answer in the minor leagues is nothing. You're not making anything. You're probably paying for, you know, by the time you take out what you have to spend on just to be a ball player in the minor leagues, you're probably paying the team.
For sure. You end up losing money. I would work in the off season, and the money I saved up would help me through the season. I made $2,250 a month for the 5 months of the season. So it was only April to August to play in AAA, my last year in AAA with my original contract with the Blue Jays. And we were going to spring training, and that year before that season, I already had a son, and my buddy, who was a first rounder, had already made the big leagues. We had an apartment, and we essentially got kicked out of the apartment because they hadn't cleaned it yet. But then they found out when they got there before we did, that we were baseball players. And so they tried to price gouge us and tried to overprice the apartment that they hadn't even cleaned yet.
Mm.
And so he went and found an apartment that, to this day, I still don't know how much extra the apartment was, but we had agreed that we would pay, Sarah and I, my wife, would pay $1,000, and they would pay $1,000. Well, he went and got an apartment that was more expensive and said, look, like, I know you agreed to $1,000, just pay us that. And when we got there, I'm like, well, this is more than $1,000. This is more than a $2,000 apartment. And he's like, look, like, we got you. Like, we can cover the rest. So, like, stuff like that, like, people helped us along the way like that, because that year we used our last, I think it was $575 to pay for the first month of rent for the beginning of the season that year. And it was like, it was something that we needed a place to stay. We couldn't room with other people. We had a kid, and, you know, everyone else at AA didn't have kids, or most of them weren't even married. So it's like that you sit there, and kind of like I said before, why are you doing this? Like, why are you still doing this? Well, now I'm at the end of my original contract. I'm going to become a free agent. Teams are going to want me. They are definitely going to want me. And then I'm going to have an opportunity in the big leagues. Probably an ignorant thing to think, and the smart, intelligent thing to do for somebody that has a college degree, a business degree, would be to quit and to go and get a job and support your family. Like, you have a responsibility, you have a family. I didn't, but it was because of people like David Percy and David and Kate Percy. He was a first rounder with the Blue Jays. And, like, so I can't sit here and say, wow, this whole story of my career, it's all about me. It's all about what I did. It's people that were in my corner and helped me in different situations. But the money you make in the minor leagues, they want you to quit, is what was always like. They're not looking to keep you around. Like, they pay you enough to make you want to quit or get better, or, you know, they're not like, wow, you can just stay here and make a decent salary in the minor leagues. No. They keep that carrot dangled for you.
You know, the sport of baseball has changed so much in the last 13 years, 14 years since you made your major league debut in 2010. And I don't know if there's any position that will be, has been, and certainly will be transformed more than the catcher's position. First of all, if you just look from 2010 until right now, I think, and you know this, I don't. I'm a guy who reads, you know, about sports on the internet. I don't really know the sport like you do, and like, you know, AJ does, and Adam Jones and the other guys that you work with on Foul Territory. But even between 2010 and now, not even factoring in, you know, what's coming down the line, which we'll talk about, the way that I feel like catchers are evaluated has changed dramatically. Would you have been evaluated differently, both coming out of college and then, you know, evaluated in terms of your output on the field, both offensively and defensively? Did your skill set match up more to what, I put in air quotes, used to be valued more for catchers versus what right now, today, I think is more valued for catchers, you know, which is framing and conducting a game as opposed to, you know, what I think, you know, the Neanderthal view of catchers was that they should be big old slugging catchers like Johnny Bench and, you know, things like that and Yogi Berra.
I actually benefited from a lot of this framing and the metrics framing is really the huge metric that they are valuing catchers on. And I think I've always been a great receiver. I congratulate my two best coaches, Ernie Witt and Mike Basso, two guys that really taught me how to receive the ball correctly. Now what they're doing is they're ripping the ball back into the strike zone and trying to deceive the umpires into calling it a strike. So it's a completely different view of how to catch. I didn't catch from one knee. I caught a traditional stance, and yet all of my receiving numbers, which has really driven this whole one knee thing, were off the charts. I was a elite level. The one year with the Indians in AAA, I was whole runs ahead of other guys in receiving in AAA, and I did it my way. My value was out there, and that's why I kept getting a job. That's why teams kept trading for me. So the receiving was part of it, but I was able to meld in kind of like old school catching in a sense and the new school receiving numbers. Like guys would, like coaches that would teach receiving, they would sit there and be like, well, I don't know how you get such great numbers receiving. Like you don't do this and you don't do that. So it was something that they would sit there, and I was kind of, no, I wasn't a contrarian, but I just showed them that there's principles that they're missing when they're teaching this type of receiving because they've never done it. The guys that were teaching this had never done it in the real world, what we called the jungle. They had never done it out in the jungle. They had just done it on paper, and they made PowerPoint presentations. And I was like, hey, if you get down on your knee, you'll be lower, and your glove will hit the ground, and then you come up through it. Well, what happens if you're a stiff glove kind of catcher? What happens if you are not athletic and can catch from a knee? They're like, well, you have to catch from a knee. Every single person has to catch from the knee. It's like, to me, that ruins some people's careers, which was happening before. It was happening before these guys came in with their receiving ideas. Like, there were scouts that would say, nope, you can't hit with batting gloves on. Well, what happens if my hands start bleeding? Oh, you got to toughen up. Well, then I can't hit for 2 weeks. Well, then you're not going to be able to make it. You know, there's always been coaches that think there's only one way and that one way is the right way, and if you don't do it their way, you're not good enough, which is so far from the truth. The truth is, catching is a position that there's a value in receiving, there's a value in blocking, there's a value in throwing guys out, and there's a value in calling pitches. How do you get the most out of yourself in that game for your team to get the W? And that is where old school meets new school, and my career kind of cross-sectioned in the receiving. And, you know, I hit home runs. If there was one thing that I did do, I hit home runs. I didn't hit many of them. You know, I didn't have many at-bats either to hit home runs, but I did hit four backup catchers. I did hit home runs, and it was something that, you know, from an old school standpoint, new school standpoint, they could care less. I've heard people say, it does not matter what you do with your bat. You know, we need you to do this behind a dish. Okay, that's the truth. Until you're hitting 150, they're going to fire you most of the time. We're not all Martin Maldonado, but Martin Maldonado hits 150 when he's got a year or two in the big leagues. They're going to go get somebody else, without a doubt.
I have so many questions. I'm going to keep on throwing them at you if that's cool. So, you know, we talked, I mentioned I wanted to talk about this, and you mentioned one of the three things that that to me as an observer and a fan would mean huge changes to the position. You mentioned one of them, and that is calling a game. Pitchers now call their games because of the new technology. And to me, that seems like a huge shift in the relationship between the pitcher and the catcher, and you know, even just the roles and responsibilities of a catcher. Is it that big of a deal? Is it a huge deal? Like, from someone who would know, what does that really mean to the game and to the position of both catcher and pitcher?
You mean, what does it mean? What does it mean if pitchers call their own game?
Well, pitchers are calling their own pitches a lot more now with the new technology, right? Like it feels to me like it's completely changed, right? Like that to me feels like a pretty massive, almost like the change, you know, back in the NFL in the 70s and 80s, where it went from, you know, the quarterback calling the plays on the field to the coach, right? All of a sudden things got a lot more serious. And it seems like to me pitchers calling their own pitches instead of the catchers would be a big deal, but maybe it's not. Maybe I'm misreading that. I'm curious what you, like, you know, you almost went through it, or maybe even did a little bit with 2020.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't have the PitchCom. When I was playing, PitchCom was introduced in 21, but I saw it coming, and I think it's great that they call their own game. If they call their own game, I think it's great. But it doesn't mean it's only them calling it. Catchers can shake off. Catchers can let the guy call it. You know what? There's no such thing as a bad pitch. There's just a bad result or a bad commitment to the pitch. Like, you have to be committed to whatever you throw. Even I heard stories of guys throwing to veteran catchers going, well, I don't even throw a curveball, but he thinks I should throw one. I think I've tried it before. I'll do it. If he thinks it's a good call, I'll do it. And it's something that you throw something with 100% conviction, that is the right pitch. If you call something as a catcher, and you're not even convicted to it, the pitcher's not going to be convicted to it. And that's ultimately where it ends. That's where it ends, because he has to throw it. So him hitting that button and saying and telling me he wants a fastball, let's go. I'm here to catch it. Let's go. I might not agree with it, but there's times when guy shakes me off and I'm like, I don't know that I agree with this, but we're doing it. But there's also times that I'm going out to the mound going, look, man, I know you want to throw a fastball here. Please just throw me one more slider before we go back to the fastball. Okay. And we talked about it, you know, but now they have a system that you don't need to go back out to the mound. So I really have no problem with it, as long as it is still a conversation that's had between the catcher and the pitcher in some way, some shape or form.
When you're watching a game and the catcher goes out to talk to the pitcher, do you know based on the situation and what's going on, do you know what they're talking about out there? Are you just like, oh, I know exactly what they're going through. They're doing this, and this, watching the games right now.
No, I don't. I can surmise, but I'd have to watch, I'd have to watch the whole game. I'd have to see, did that person shake them off? Wait, this is a pinch hitter. They're probably just going over, what this guy can and can't do. Or it depends on the pitcher, and some it depends on the catcher. They could be saying left and they're saying right. Like, I could be completely off, but normally you get kind of in the realm. Sometimes they're stalling. Sometimes they're giving a guy a break. Sometimes, if I know the guy, I know he wants to throw a changeup here. And I know the catcher does not want to throw a changeup here. And so, you have to, the only way you know what they're talking about is if you know the people.
How much will the coming, air quotes, robot umpires change the catcher position? More than people would think, or not as much? I would imagine it's going to change it at least a little bit, right? In terms of, potentially, framing, potentially not being as valued as much. Don't know. But I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on both which version you think is coming and what impact there is to the catching position based on that.
I think the version that they have in the minor leagues with the challenge system is what I think is coming. And I think it still allows the human element, still allows the receiving element that will not really change the game too much. Now, if teams figure out how to manipulate that challenge, that receiving element, where you run out of challenges, now it's not, now the receiving is important. If they figure out how to mitigate that and they never actually need the receiving part of it because the challenges get to the point where everybody just challenges and you can never deke the umpire or deke the hitter, it's something that I think it would change the catching position immensely. I think you'd start seeing left fielders who can't play left field getting thrust into the catching position because they have a good arm. But that's only without the challenge system. The challenge system still enables, because like you said, pitchers are going to call their own game. The thing I'm fearful of with the pitch com is that the pitch com is going to start going on the bench. The pitch com is going to start going in front offices and they're going to just base it on the numbers. And that would be bad. I hope we keep it on the field. It has to stay on the field, the pitch com. But if you don't have a receiving aspect of the game now, and the only reason receiving is so valued is because they have a value on what a called strike is compared to a called ball. And it's worth half a base. So if a base is worth 0.22, a received strike compared to received ball is worth 0.11. And so if you receive two strikes, that values more than a stolen base. Well, if you take away the receiving number value, now you got to have guys that are actually throwing guys out on the bases, blocking the ball so that guys don't get to the next base, which honestly, the best catchers still do. not just the gimmick receiving catchers. It's the best catchers. They still do it. It's just organizations are like, well, that only happens, I forget what the number is, like 12% of the time or 11% of the time a ball is blocked or somebody steals a base. And so they're saying that it's not as valued as how many times you receive a ball that could be called a strike. So that value, throwing guys out, blocking balls, would be back up the list again because receiving wouldn't matter because it's all robo umpires. But with the challenge system, I still think you need it, so you won't see a huge change.
You mentioned a couple of coaches who helped you along the way. Do you have a particular favorite major league manager that you play for whatever reason? Could have been because, you know, they were helpful to you, or because how you just compare how they were at managing to other managers you played for. Do you have a favorite?
I have two in different categories. I mean, there's a lot of great managers I played for. Joe Girardi was awesome. I played for Rob Thompson, who's a manager now, but he was one of the best bench coaches I ever played for, just in their ability to know the game. But for me, the two that I think of are Charlie Manuel. Yes, his knowledge, his ability, all that stuff. But he's the first manager that really stuck his neck out there for me, thought I was a good player, and gave me an opportunity. So I will forever be grateful for that. And Craig Counsell, I think right now, is the best manager in the game. And it's not taking anything away from anybody else. It's not, you know, Bob Melvin, Bruce Bochy. I never played for Melvin, but I played for Boch. They're great managers. But I think Craig Counsell, what he does with what he has, what he's given, is far and above what other guys are doing. And I think he is. And that's everything. That's X's and O's. That's staying locked in. That's keeping guys loose. That's, you know, having good conversations with guys, having tough conversations with guys. It's everything. So yeah, those two guys are really, they made a huge mark in my big league career for sure.
What about a teammate? Was there coming up you mentioned again, one of your roommates, your teammates who did something really amazing for you and your family, but you know, particularly in when you got to the big leagues, a particular teammate who could have been your favorite for, again, any reason. Could be because they really sort of mentored you, showed you the ropes, because you just have that kind of relationship. Who's your favorite teammate you've had?
I always say my favorite teammate is Pete Orr, because one, nobody knows who Pete Orr is, but two, he was always so funny, very self-deprecating, but incredibly, incredibly positive toward the rest of his teammates. And he was just always one of my favorite teammates. But then they're like, well, we don't know who that was. How about somebody we know who it was? And for me, it was, and still is, Raul Ibanez. He was with the Phillies. He was 39 years old. I was 30. And just his work ethic, his awareness of the rest of his teammates, and just his humbleness about the game. Like, he knew how hard the game was, and he was always trying to learn, always trying to build his teammates up. And so for me, Raul was a very, at, you know, pivotal time in my career. I had made the big leagues the year before and gotten released, and I signed with the Phillies on a minor league contract, and, you know, really getting to know him in spring training. Then getting to know him when I got called up to the big leagues, from everything, from how to be a dad in the big leagues, how to be a big leaguer, how to, you know, nutrition stuff, how to work out, and all things that I thought I was pretty good at. He just really encouraged me, whether he knew he encouraged me or not. It was just how he lived his life. And so I owe a lot to him.
You know, you said you hit some homers, and you did. You hit 31 career regular season home runs in the major leagues. That's impressive. What was you? I mean, it's a dumb question, but I'll ask it because I want to know, because I'm pretty confident you'll be able to describe it perfectly. You remember your first big league home run?
Oh, yeah. Tom Gorzolani, 0-2 pitch. I'm sorry, 1-2 pitch, home run to dead center field at Citizens Bank Park, put us down 3 runs. We were losing 5-1. It made it 5-2.
Nice. What time of the year was that? Beginning of the year, middle of the year?
It was 2012. It was, I'm going to say, May-ish.
Nice. Very good.
Yep.
Love that.
Hit home run.
What do you have a particular home run that stands out? Again, for whatever reason, could be because it won a game, could be because it was, just off somebody or something like. And do you have a favorite home run or home runs?
Anytime you hit a home run in the ninth inning, I think it's probably one of your favorite home runs. Anytime you get a big hit in the late innings, eighth, ninth, tenth innings, that kind of thing. I hit a game tying home run against Craig Kimbrell. On an 0-2
he's
fastball.
Pretty good.
He was pretty good. And then the next year I hit a game tying home run off of Aroldis Chapman. And at that point, when I did that, I was the only person to have homered off of both Aroldis Chapman and Craig Kimbrell.
Nice.
So that was something that was cool for me.
That's awesome. You have some postseason experience as well. Now, I don't, and I'll ask the question. Like, you were on the roster for the World Series in 2014 with the Royals, if I have that right.
You are very correct.
What was that like, and what do you, not a lot, not a lot of people have hit 31 home runs, and I bet even less people have been to and, on the field, suited up in uniform for a World Series. What do you remember from that?
Oh, my goodness.
Or what stands out, I guess, is probably a better question. And what do you remember? What do I remember? What are you talking about?
So many things. There's so many things I remember in the moment. And to this day, I could care less that I didn't get in that bat the entire playoffs. There was probably 9 times from the wild card game till the last out in game seven that I was going into the game. Had Salvador Perez, who was at bat with Alex Gordon on third base, had he gotten a single, I would have came in and caught the 10th inning, the top of the 10th inning after not catching the entire playoffs.
Right.
I was coming in. And I remember the feeling that each of those times, because it happened, I remember there's a distinct time in the 10th inning of the Angels series where we had just gone up by a run and Salvi was up. Had he gotten a hit, I would have gone in the game. And I remember thinking how locked in and focused I was, how like all the scatter reports, it was just like, I knew I was going to do well. And that's all I had. For 4 years, I had that memory seared in my mind that I was going to be ready to be in the game and I was going to do well. I was going to do like, I wasn't nervous to be in the game.
Right.
I remember thinking that. And so in 2018, when I finally got to play my first playoff game with the Brewers, game one, I got in there for defense and I was ready to go. And then I got my at-bats and I was ready to go. And so it really took me back to that 2014 when some people still come up to me today and say, oh, you should have at least gotten one at bat. And my mindset was, if me pinch hitting when we're winning 10-0 in game 6 of the World Series meant somebody else that was going to play in game 7, because I wasn't going to play in game 7 unless something happened, that if that at bat meant more to that person so that they would be ready in game 7, I would give that at bat up 100 times over 100. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't, because that one at bat, like just to say, I'm not big into being like, I mean, I guess this is counterintuitive. You wrote a book about your career, but I'm not big into people like congratulating me. Like I'm really out there for the team. And if someone else needs that at bat, I 100% will let them have it. But I did the night before game 7, because we knew we were going to face Bumgarner at some point.
Yeah.
I had a dream that I hit a home run off of Madison Bumgarner.
Wow.
Probably because we had a very, like, we talked a lot about Madison Bumgarner. Mm. Like, this is what he does. This is, we saw a lot. You see highlights.
Sure.
You knew that was going to happen. I wasn't in the World Series hitting the home run off of him. I just knew when I woke up that I hit a home run off of Madison Bumgarner. I think it's a funny story. Well, the next time I faced Madison Bumgarner in 2016, 2 years later, I hit a home run off of Madison
Bumgarner.
Well,
there you go. That's
so
amazing.
If they had put me in, Coach, we'd have won the World Series.
It was clearly coming in the next at bat. Clearly.
Yes.
Speaking of, but you touched on it, but I want to talk about this. You mentioned the 2018 playoffs in the National League Division Series. You got the at-bats, and you made pretty much the most of them. I mean, your batting average was only .625, 8 plate appearances, 5 hits, a double, 2 RBIs. What was that like, being able to be asked to perform and then delivering in the postseason for all the world to see and delivering like that, man?
Again, I guess I was kind of ignorant, like until JP Momorosi interviewed me after game 3 in Colorado. Like, I knew I had done well, but I didn't know I hit .625. You know, I knew I had hits. But all it was a few games. Like, I had a few games before in my career that I had done that. And so in my mind, I was proud of myself that I had really locked in to the fact that I was just trying to make it just like any other game. Now, the adrenaline was not like any other game. The crowd was not like any other game. But when I had success, it was like, yeah, I've done this before. And then, like, for a split second, you hear the crowd and you're like, whoa, maybe I didn't do it at this moment before. Like, this was, they were amped. So it was really cool. It really was cool. But again, like, I'm so glad that I'm not sitting there going, I showed you guys. Like, that's such a fleeting, just a almost selfish kind of way to live. And I've seen people that do that and it eats them up. And I've seen people that it motivates them. And that just wasn't something for me. It was so cool to come back to my phone after all the celebrating, the champagne bottles, the interviews. I come back to my phone and I have 346 new text messages. And so that kind of stuff is, you know, with, like, people are like, my buddies are like, oh man, they made a GIF out of you. That's unbelievable. Like, you are a legend, you know, stuff like that. And other people just saying how proud they are of me, which is something that was really, really awesome.
You had, if my information is correct, and my good friends at Baseball Reference are the ones who are telling me, so I'm sure it is, you had one major league stolen base. What are the circumstances behind that stolen base?
Yeah, it was a long time coming. They never let me run. I had plenty of speed to steal bases. I was, you know, people are like, oh, he's a catcher, he doesn't have enough speed. You don't need a lot of speed to steal bases. They just never let me run. And part of it too, I didn't get on base a ton, so there wasn't a ton of opportunities. But it was that year in 18, and I told, just like I told every other manager I played for, look, if the guy is a 155 to the plate, I promise I can steal and I will make it. I will not get thrown out. And 155 is slow to the plate, but there's plenty of guys that are slower than that when I'm on first base because they're like, he's not running. So, like, there's one time I got a base hit against Jonathan Papelbon, and he told the first baseman, oh, don't even hold him on. And so I look in the dugout, and the manager at the time was Pete McKinnon. And I'm like, Pete, I'm like, let me go. No, it wasn't Pete McKinnon. It was Clint Hurdle with the Pirates. I was like, hey, he's not letting me on. He gives me like the two hands, like, no, stay there. Like, I'm not an idiot. I can make it. Like, I had seasons in the minor leagues where I was, you know, 5 for 5, 7 for 7, 6 for 7. So I'll go when the guy's slow. So it finally happened. We were in Pittsburgh, and it was a runner on third, and I I picked the count, asked the first base coach, and he's like, yeah, it's perfect. Go for it. Stole, no throw.
So uncontested. I wanted the base. I love it.
Uncontested. I wanted the base. But after the game, the grounds crew didn't even know what I was talking about. I had our equipment guy go and ask for it. So I don't have the base. I have the ball because the next pitch was fouled off. So I have the ball.
Okay. That's something. Not the base, but that's something. That's awesome. I love that.
It's pretty apropos for my career.
All right. I'm going to let you go. I've kept you on for so long. I do have one more question, though.
Okay.
Catchers manage. Some of the best managers of all time were catchers. Will you manage in the major leagues? Do you want to manage in the major leagues? Or are you cool doing something different?
I'm cool being a dad and a husband. If those things line up for me to manage in the big leagues, I will 100% manage in the big leagues. I want to make impacts on players and their careers and their lives at the most that I can, the most I can make those impacts. And if that's as a manager, great. If it's never in pro ball and it's in high school, great. I don't need to manage for my own glory. I know I would be a good manager. I've been offered incredible jobs since I've quit baseball in the big leagues, not managerial jobs, but jobs that would in a few years lead to being a manager. And it's been easy to turn them down because I really want to be home, and I have an opportunity to do, podcasts, shows, interviews from home. While I'm staying up to 11 o'clock right now doing this one, it's something I get to go and sleep in the same bed as my wife. And when you're a player, when you're a manager, it's not like that. So when my kids are out of the house and my wife Sarah says, yeah, let's do it. I want to travel everywhere with you. She'll be right up front in the plane, in the front row, sitting next to me, and I'll be able to impact guys in the big leagues that way, if that's how it's supposed to be. Or maybe I'll be out of the game too long and they'll be like, oh, the game's passed you by. And I'll say, that is completely fine. If you don't think I can do it, I am not going to force you to put me in that position, and I'll be able to impact people positively in another way.
I love it. The book is The Tao of the Backup Catcher, Playing Baseball for the Love of the Game. And if you can't tell, the love of the game completely defines Eric Kratz. Eric, I could go on for another hour. I won't. Thank you so much for your time. The show is Foul Territory on YouTube and podcast and stadium and everywhere. Thank you so much for being here. Hopefully, can we talk again some other time in the future about baseball and your career and stuff like that?
I would love it. I would love it. But you might not have any more questions after read the book.
I've written 15 more down. That'll come from the book, I guarantee it. Thank you so much for being here. Have a great night. Enjoy the rest of the baseball season.
Perfect. I appreciate it.